Please help me in welcoming Speaker Newt Gingrich to Nationwide.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I want to thank Nationwide for hosting this. I think it's extraordinarily important that we return politics to being a conversation like this, and that we have spaces in our society where people can come to actually talk about where we're at, what we have to do, and where we're going. I think this is the most important election of modern times, because I think we're at enormous crossroads that relate to every aspect of our life. We're at crossroads economically, we're at crossroads constitutionally, we're at a crossroads in national security, we're at crossroads in our core values. And I think the conversation and the choice we'll make next year is really, really a big deal. So what I want to do is outline very briefly three kind of layers of principled choice, and then toss it open to you and let you ask anything you want to. But I want to start from the premise that we have historically been able to talk with ourselves and really achieve remarkable things. Let me give you one example that comes from Iowa history. Do any of you remember what happened at Council Bluffs in 1859? I'm a former history teacher. There's no grade attached to this, but would anybody like to guess what happened at Council Bluffs in 1859? It relates to Abraham Lincoln. It's very important. In 1859, on the edge of running for president, Abraham Lincoln goes to Council Bluffs, looks across the Missouri, and talks about a transcontinental railroad. Now, he does this at a time when we don't have a steel-making capacity large enough to build steel rails to cross the West. We don't have tunneling capacity to dig through the Sierra Nevadas. And there are no engines strong enough to pull trains across the Sierra Nevadas. That's 1859. We complete the Transcontinental Railroad in 1869. But what makes it truly an example of visionary leadership is that Abraham Lincoln, who was born in 1809, first ran for office and lost for the state legislature in 1832 at the age of 23. One of the planks in his platform in 1832 in his first race is to build railroads. Now, understand how visionary this was. The modern locomotive pooled railroad is invented by Stephenson in Great Britain in 1829 with a railroad engine called the Rocket. The first one arrives in the United States from Great Britain in 1831. Lincoln, a year later, has never seen a train, but he's read about it. And he realizes, any of you who recognize the Great Prairies that start in Illinois, that having walked across the prairie and having had ox carts pulled across the prairie, this idea of a railroad was really cool. And so as a visionary, he proposed something that he'd never seen. He actually made a good bit of money in the 1850s as a railroad lawyer. Now, the reason I'm telling you this story is, up until the mid-1960s, we were a country that believed in the future. We were a country that believed in technology. And our elite culture gradually became cynical and negative and frightened. I used to tell people that if Thomas Edison invented the electric light in the modern era, it would be reported in a story that the candle-making industry was threatened today. And somebody on the left would point out that electricity can kill, and the entire thing is a plot to hurt the poor on behalf of rich people. Now, somehow, you don't get very far into the future if you hide from it. So I want to give you three levels: pragmatism, practicality, principles, and values that will, I believe, next year will be the widest choice in American history. And one of the reasons that I will challenge the president to 7 3-hour debates in the Lincoln-Douglas tradition with a timekeeper and no moderator is I think we need a serious, in-depth conversation about the mess we're in, which is far beyond President Obama. This mess has been growing for 30 years. He is only a symptom of it, but he is not the defeating him by itself is not a solution. We need much deeper change than just replacing the president. So let me start with pragmatism and practicality. And all of you actually represent this. We were just talking about that young people ought to have the right to have a personal Social Security savings account in which they would be allowed to take their half of the Social Security tax. They could put it into an account they would control. It would build up compound interest their entire lifetime. This is not a theory. We know that in Chile and in Galveston, Texas, this has actually been working for over 30 years, and people are actually acquiring 2 to 3 times as much retirement money as they get from a transfer program. So it's not a theory. And you know that companies like yours can, in fact, manage those kind of accounts and can do it in a way that even at the depth of 07 and 08 and 09, in Chile and in Galveston, they still had far more money than they would have gotten from the regular government program. So in Chile, for example, they have a guarantee that you'll never drop below the government program, and they have not paid a single check since 1980 because nobody's dropped below. So that's an example of something that we know is real because it's being done. I'm going to give you a couple examples. There's a world that works, much of it but not all of it in the private sector, and there's a world that fails, much of it but not all of it in the government sector. So let me give you an example of the world that works and the world that fails. How many of you have ever gone online to track a package at UPS or FedEx? Raise your hand if you've ever gone online. Just this morning. I could say how many of you think you probably will between now and Christmas. I mean, right? Okay, so but here's the point I want to make, which one of the reasons I'm running for president is I could never get this across in Washington. This is not a theory, right? This is a fact. You can actually have technology that tracks 24 million packages a day between UPS and FedEx while they're moving. So this is a fact. The world that works. So over here, you're tracking 24 million packages at no extra cost while they move. Over here, you have the federal government, which cannot find 11 million illegal aliens while they're sitting still. So one of my proposals is that we mail a package to every person who's here illegally. And then when they're delivered, you pull it up in the computer, you know exactly where they are, and then it was done at no extra cost. Now, you know, I just want to say for the purpose of our friends in the press, you know that was hyperbole and that is not a serious proposal. Because the last thing I want to do is have the New York Times write some column about how stupid Gingrich is because he actually thinks you could do this. So let me give you a practical, real example that actually relates to something all of you do regularly. How many of you have ever been called by a credit card company to make sure that you were the person using your credit card? Raise your hand. Okay, so again, not a theory, right? American Express, Visa, MasterCard, etc., have systems sophisticated enough that in virtually real time, they check to see whether or not the pattern is you. So that's over here, the world that works. American Express pays 0.03 of 1% to crooks. That's how powerful their anti-fraud systems are. Now over here is the world that fails. We'll call it, say, Medicaid and Medicare. Medicaid in New York State, according to the New York Times, pays over 10% to crooks. Now that means as a taxpayer, you are 330 times, that's 33,000%, more likely to pay a crook because of bad government administration than you are as a credit card holder. And we have tried now for years. We actually wrote a book at the Center for Health Transformation called, I thought this title would work in Washington, called Stop Paying the Crooks. Now, you would have thought a title like Stop Paying the Crooks would kind of penetrate, right? No interest. Congressional Budget Office won't score it, therefore it doesn't exist. In the world that fails, the Congressional Budget Office and the Office of Management Budget are the two primary protectors of failure. And so when you bring them something out of the world that works, they go, well, that can't be right, because it doesn't fit their models. So we had IBM and American Express and Visa and MasterCard, all of them prepared to show how to build a system for Medicare and Medicaid. Now, that doesn't count food stamps, it doesn't count student loans, I mean, all sorts of places where the federal government gives out money that has fraud. But just stick with Medicare and Medicaid. The estimate is that it is between $70 billion a year and $120 billion a year paid to crooks. When I say crook, I don't mean a doctor who marginally changes their code. I mean a dentist in New York State who filed 982 procedures a day. Or a dental office in Brooklyn that said, if you'll loan us your Medicaid card for 30 seconds, we will give you a free DVD player. Now, so take that model. The super committee, had they been willing to take this seriously, had sitting on the table between $700 billion and $1.2 trillion in savings just by not paying crooks. And you just couldn't get their attention because it's a strange idea. Yet every single one of the people in the super committee uses credit cards. This is how bad the current system is. And this is why I'm so intrigued with Strong America Now, because they want to bring the concept of Lean Six Sigma as a management system to the federal government. I was at a factory in New Hampshire that makes automobile parts. They showed me one part that they'd made 2 million of last year. They had one error in 2 million. Their goal this year is to have zero errors. But I thought to myself, just stick at the 1 out of 2 million and then go to the Department of Labor or the IRS and imagine the total number of mistakes a year per transaction compared to one error in 2 million, and you see the difference. So the first level of difference is I'm campaigning because I want to bring the world that works into government to dramatically, fundamentally change it and move it to the tempo, the leanness, the efficiency, the effectiveness that we routinely demand in other parts of the world. The second level is principles. We know how to create jobs. Ronald Reagan came into office with an economy that was a disaster, turned it around almost immediately. If you apply the Reagan recovery to our current population size, it would be 25 million new jobs in about 7 years. In September of 1983, in 1 month, the American people created 1,100,000 new jobs because of Reagan's policies. And it's not complicated. Cut taxes, cut regulations, develop American energy, and reward and encourage and praise people who create jobs. Now, what's the current administration policy? Raise taxes, increase regulations, oppose American energy, and have class warfare against the people who create jobs. I mean, you could hardly be further apart as a matter of principle. And so you can go through a series of principled choices, and you really end up in a very different world depending on which principles you apply. So I favor Adam Smith and The Wealth of Nations and Alexander Hamilton and The First Report of Manufacturers. The president favors Saul Alinsky and Rules for Radicals. Now, there's only one problem with that. Alinsky doesn't work. It's not a model for the real world. I mean, it's an interesting academic exercise for people who want to fantasize a world of left-wing radicalism, but when you try to do it in the real world, people quit. They just say, I'm not going to create, you go out and talk to small businesses, they're not going to create any new jobs as long as Obamacare exists. They're not going to create any new jobs as long as the president's attacking them, and they're not going to create any new jobs as long as they're in a position that they have no idea what next year's taxes will be. And so you're stuck at stagnation, which is why the number one symbol next year will be food stamps versus paychecks. Because I would argue the president is the most effective food stamp president in American history. I would like to be the most effective paycheck president. Fundamentally different policies. One last example. Remember I said Reagan favored American energy. I favor ethanol. I voted for it when it was called gasohol in 1984 under Ronald Reagan. And I favor it for a very practical reason. I want the United States to create not just economic sufficiency. I want us to have a surplus of energy so if something happens in the Persian Gulf, we can ensure that the industrial world doesn't slide into a deep depression. I mean, when you have all the dangers you have today in Iran, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, the idea that we don't have a national energy strategy to create a surplus of energy to be the world's reservoir in case something disastrous happens is frankly like driving at 200 miles an hour on a wet highway with no seatbelt. It makes no sense as a national strategy. So let's take ethanol. If my choice is for the next $1 billion to go to Iran or Iowa, I pick Iowa. If the next $1 billion is going to go to Saudi Arabia or South Dakota, I pick South Dakota. No, this economic nationalism to me makes sense when you're talking about an issue of national security. But I also favor oil and gas. I also favor the development of coal. I also favor nuclear and solar and wind. You're the second largest wind-producing place in the world after Denmark. More electricity is produced from wind in Iowa than any other place except Denmark. And I'm for that. In fact, what I would do is I would have the tax credits be 10-year tax credits with an annual renewal so that capital would be invested in the industries. It's very destructive for Congress to pass short-term tax credits because it minimizes capital investment. So let's look at energy for a second. Two quick examples. Because the Bakken formation of North Dakota is on private land, the president couldn't stop its development. And as a result, North Dakota unemployment currently is about 3%. Now, you would think there's a hint that it's really a good idea to develop American energy because it has high value-added jobs. It actually pays taxes and royalties to the government. I'm for higher revenue from a bigger economy. I'm against higher taxes. By contrast, the president goes to Brazil. He says to the Brazilians, I'm really proud that you have developed offshore, and I would like for America to be your best customer. Now, I think that's exactly backwards. I don't think you want an American president to go around the world as a purchasing agent for foreign products. I think you want an American president to go around the world as a salesman for American products to create American jobs. Fundamentally different vision of the world. Lastly, values. A major reason I got back in public life and I decided to run started with the Ninth Circuit Court's decision in 2002 that one nation under God as part of the Pledge of Allegiance was unconstitutional. And to me, it was sort of the final wake-up call of an erosion that had been going on since 1963 when the court first ruled that school prayer was unconstitutional. So I began as a historian digging into stuff. I wrote a book called Rediscovering God in America. We then made it into a movie. I've since written other books. I did an entire section, if you go to newt.org, which is my the campaign website, just my first name.org, there's a whole paper on reforming the judiciary. But I realize there's a deeper, more fundamental part of this that is a real value struggle about the nature of life. Our founding political document, the Declaration of Independence, the founding fathers say we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, people don't often stop and reflect. Lincoln, on his way to being inaugurated in 1861, stopped in Philadelphia and gave a speech at Independence Hall and said that there was no major part of his political philosophy that did not start with the Declaration of Independence because it was such a radical document. When you talk about American exceptionalism, you're really talking about the Declaration of Independence. Not that we're exceptional as individuals, not even that we're exceptional as a society, but that the claim that is made in the Declaration of Independence is so extraordinary. Because think about what it says. It says, power comes from God to each one of you personally. You are personally sovereign. In fact, your rights are unalienable. That means no judge, no bureaucrat, no politician has the right to take away your rights. No other society in history has said this. This means you are a citizen, not a subject. Because you loan power to the government does not loan power to you. Now, there are tremendous underlying implications from this. And we have now, for about 50 years, been drifting away from these implications. One is that we're always subordinate to God. Where do your rights come from? You know, our friends on the secular left basically argue, well, we're randomly gathered protoplasm, and fortunately we didn't show up as rhinoceroses. That's not what the Declaration says. The Declaration says our rights come directly from our Creator, which means if you are determined to drive God out of public life entirely, you are eliminating the core explanation of being an American. Because then you get to be like the Europeans. But if you watch in Europe right now, all of the elites are desperately trying to avoid the people of those countries having anything to say about what's going on. Because they know they're going to repudiate them. I mean, the Greeks are not going to vote voluntarily to reduce their standard of living by 33% in order to please the Germans. And so the answer of the Europeans is don't let them vote. And we're right at the edge of this. When you deal with the Environmental Protection Agency, you're dealing with Washington bureaucrats who think we're subjects and they're sovereign. You deal with modern federal judges. They think we're stupid and they get to redefine the world however they want to. But think about it. When people tell you the Supreme Court right now is divided, four on one side, four on the other, with Justice Kennedy in the middle, and you'll read these analysis of cases, how will Justice Kennedy decide? This means he becomes a one-person constitutional convention. Now, do any of you seriously believe the Founding Fathers thought that one lawyer should be able to randomly rewrite the Constitution based on his mood that week? This is how far we've come from the core system. So part of the debate next year will be over whether we're going to remain America, reassert American exceptionalism, reapply the 10th Amendment, shrink the government of Washington, reassert that you, not the bureaucrat, is in charge, and rebuild the sense in our schools of actually learning American history. This will be a tremendous fight, because the left will deeply oppose it. But I think it's central to our survival as a country. I think if we give up where our rights come from, and we give up American history, for all practical purposes, we cease to be American in the historic tradition. So I am campaigning because I think for this country to get back on track, we have to be practical and use the world that works, we have to apply the principles that work, and we have to reassert the values of American history. And I'll just close with this comment. This is going to be so hard that I do not ask anyone to be for me. Because if you're for me, you say you're going to vote for me and go home and say, I sure hope Newt fixes it. That is impossible. The scale of change we need requires me to ask you to be with me for the next 8 years. I need you to stand side by side to remind the Congress, to remind the state legislature, the governor, the school boards, the city councils, county commissions. Second, I need you to stay active because if change on this scale, we're going to make mistakes. And we need to build social networks so you can say that didn't quite work, or you're a little bit off track, or the world has changed, or here's a better idea. If 305 million Americans want to rebuild the country, it'll be easy. If only a few people in Washington want to rebuild the country, it'll be impossible. But there's a final reason. If we're going to shrink the Washington bureaucracy by applying the 10th Amendment, we have to grow citizenship at home. There's no alternative. Otherwise, there's a vacuum. And so I'm asking you to be with me in part to reestablish real citizenship and to recognize that whether you're a parent or a grandparent or an aunt or an uncle, you have responsibilities in your community, in your neighborhood, and that we're all going to have to roll up our sleeves and be a little bit more responsible in the next 30 years if we're going to get America rebuilt and if the country we love is going to be for our children and grandchildren the kind of country it has been for us. So that is a sweeping overview, and I think I've got time to... Can I toss open to questions? Yeah.